Hey there, and welcome to the Smart and Simple Matters show with your host, Joel Zeslowski. I plan to whistle you a ditty, then hum you a tune, but my son Grant insisted I do a horse impression instead. So here you go. This is episode number 18. It's another exciting episode, but before we crank this up, I just want to give a shout out to Aaron Currup, who recently wrote a review of the show on iTunes. Aaron said, "There aren't many podcasts out there for which I'll listen to every episode, but this is one of them. Joel's quirky sense of humor, very quirky, thank you, Aaron, honesty and determination to open up conversations around the topics he's passionate about make for an interesting and entertaining show. He asks great questions of his guests and isn't afraid to tackle major topics head on." So, Aaron, I just want to say thanks a ton for the review and for the kind words. And that's not the only thing that I'm thankful for today. My guest today, his name is Mike Vardy, and I was impressed with him even before I knew he existed. And you might say, how the heck is that? Well, Mike used to be the behind-the-scenes force for lifehack.org, which is a website I have a lot of respect for. And he even worked with me to get my first guest post published on Lifehack and polished it up into something nice. Now, he's since moved on from being managing editor at Lifehack, but I haven't moved on from following him around the internet. In fact, I and many other folks are even more interested in what Mike has to say these days after meeting him in person at New Media Expo in January. He's really starting to get known for his recent book, The Front Nine, How to Start the Year You Want Anytime You Want, among two other groovy books. As a productivity pro and time management thought leader, a prolific podcaster with his popular Mike's on Mike podcast, a dynamite public speaker, and in some circles, as a pretty dynamite husband and dad living in Victoria, British Columbia with his wife, Anne, his son, Colton, and his daughter, Grace. He's also done a stint as productivity expert for Success Magazine's audio CD, and I hear he used to do improv comedy as well, and occasionally likes to still get as funky as I do. So welcome, Mike. Glad to have you on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Joel. Great to be here.
Cool. Well, this is going to go in different directions. There's some things that I'm really, really looking forward to asking you about, and I know you have some great wisdom and some insight to share with all the folks who are listening today. But I thought we'd just start our chat with giving some people just a little overview of what they might be in for. So we'll probably start by talking about what I like to refer to as the seeds of awesomeness, and that'll make sense after I talk to you about the seeds of awesomeness. And we'll get into some groovy topics about how being a productivityist creates a more simple, more organized, or more money-wise existence. Plus, we can chat about the context of some thought-provoking posts you've written, as well as spreadsheets, surrounding yourself with positive people, and maybe even your take on curating, if we have time. How's that sound to you?
Sounds excellent. Hopefully I am the seeds of awesomeness that I have grew into some kind of tree or plant of awesomeness as well. We'll see.
Oh, I would imagine they would. And hey, you can feed those seeds at any point in time with a sip of water whenever you need it. You'll probably catch me taking a sip or two as we're chatting as well. So first, to talk about that, you know, most of the folks that I talk to, if it's in business, if it's in life, regardless of where I meet, in terms of who they are, the foundational pieces of what makes them tick and why they value certain things, tends to start at a pretty early age. Sometimes it's influenced by their environment, sometimes it's influenced by their parents or a mentor, or it's a whole host of things. And you've done some pretty awesome things. So maybe you can start off by telling us a little bit about one or two experiences growing up that really defined who you are and why you do some of the things that you do right now.
Well, that's a great question. I think growing up, I was always, we moved a lot. My dad had he was working for like a trucking company, so he would move from place to place. So I think I spent a little bit of time, no more than 5 years in any one place. And growing up, I grew up in Ontario, so near Toronto area. So I would be, you know, moving from place to place every few years and lose touch with people. So I started to kind of embrace being a bit of a class clown. But I also really got into writing. Like, I remember some of the things with my writing that happened early on that kind of helped foster what I do today. For example, in grade three, I remember writing in, we had journals that we had to do, and no one wanted to write in journal every day. No one wanted to. They thought, oh, what am I? And I started to write a serial in my journal. So I would actually write a science fiction type of serial in the journal. So my teacher would every day be looking forward to seeing what the next, I would always have like a to be continued at the end of each entry. So that was one thing that kind of helped foster my writing, the belief that I could really, you know, connect with people with my writing. And then I remember I wrote a short novella. Of course, I thought it was a novel back then because, you know, when you're in grade, I think it was in grade eight. I thought, well, wow, this is a lot of words, so it must be a novel. Turns out it was maybe a novella, a short story perhaps even. But I got invited to the Young Authors Conference, and just after going to that conference, we moved again. So I actually spent only about 3 months in grade eight at the school that I finished up at before going to high school. And when I went to that school, I wrote a piece. I was really into Douglas Adams, so I wrote this piece called The Green Thang and All. And I wrote it from the perspective of a guy who had a Southern accent, and he was an astronaut. And the teacher, I got the paper back, and I got an A, but initially I'd gotten a C from the teacher, and she actually had crossed out like all of her comments, which were like, what is this mean? There's no plot. I don't understand. And then she put a note underneath saying, I'm very conventional in my writing, I'm afraid. I actually asked another teacher to look at this because I knew you were fairly proficient at writing, and they said that you showed a lot of imagination and stuff, so she turned it into an A. And that was another thing that kind of said, you know, wow, maybe I am really good at this, and maybe this is something I should keep doing. And then I won the Creative Writing Award there after only being there for 3 months. So those two things helped me when I got to high school. And moving forward, I just kept coming back to the writing. Like even when I was doing stand-up, like improv and then sketch comedy, I would always come back to the writing. The productivity stuff kind of came in much later, but I always had a lot of irons in the fire, and everything seemed to always come back to creating something and primarily the written word.
Wow. So the creative force in your early life, the green thing and all, which we probably can't find on Amazon, I would imagine.
No.
And your work as an eight-year-old in your third grade class about the to be continued one, we probably can't catch that anywhere online either, huh?
No. You know what? I don't think I could. If I put it out there today, I'd have to say this was written by an eight-year-old. Because it's clearly written by an eight-year-old, but it was definitely it planted the seeds, right? It was the genesis of where I went. And I mean, I always was interested in writing comedy and looking at things. I think Jerry Seinfeld says that, you know, like comedians and people who have a comedic sort of bent look at life differently. They always look at something and wonder how it would work in a different way. And I've always kind of felt that I did that. I was never really good at sports, although I loved watching sports. I could not play them, no matter how hard I tried. I was just not good at it. But I was really good at creating either a really good story or public speaking. I used to do the Dana Carvey impression of George Bush back in high school. So I would do that, and people were right into that. So, I mean, I always was a bit of a performer and a bit of a creative person. And I think that those things kind of started back then, and then they just kept growing and growing. And I lost my way for a little bit. Well, after high school, I kind of just decided that I wanted to, I was going to follow the path that everyone kind of followed. You know, I need to make money. This is the easy way to go. I was, you know, I basically started to work for a large corporation, which I worked for 12 years, actually. I was working for Costco, and it was great. They're a great company. They're great for a lot of people. They've been in the news recently, even as, you know, kind of championing the whole like living wage thing that some other retailers just don't do. But I found that once I moved out west, what happened was that my roommate said, you got to go to this improv class. You got to go. We would do things at home that were really interesting. Like we'd have status battles. So he would pretend that I was his boss at work, and we would pretend that he didn't understand the difference between work and home. So I'd have my friends who were managers come over, and I'd ask him to wash my car, and he would go wash my car. And it was a really interesting dynamic that we had. And he said, you know, you should go to this improv class and play, and, you know, play. So I did. And the bug was back, like the creativity bug was back. But for that 12-year period, that's, I think, where I got into sort of being more organized and stuff, is I would use a day timer and I'd use different colors and highlighters and stuff like that to really keep myself organized. But once I started to go back down the comedy path, then I had to really get into learning more about productivity, because there were two different paths that I was, you know, pursuing. The path at Costco of, you know, moving up maybe, and then the path of, hey, I want to go back into the creative world. And I started to shift back towards the creative world pretty rapidly. And once I did that, productivity kind of fell in, and my love for learning about productivity is what kind of brought me to where I'm at now.
Huh. Well, we had a similar but at least geographically opposite experience in terms of working for large companies. You working for Costco for 12 years, and then me working for a company north of the border, the Royal Bank of Canada, which is where I worked for a U.S. subsidiary for about a decade until last March. So we have some parallels there in terms of our experience. And, you know, I was going to segue from the seeds of awesomeness into asking you about a productivityist, but you've kind of already done that for us. And generally speaking, and feel free, you can get as specific as you like here. You mentioned being organized and task planners and just getting more involved in time management and some of the other things that you've become known for. So how does being a productivityist create that more simple or more organized or more money-wise paradigm that you are so prominent in right now?
I think it's kind of like when you start to learn how to ride a bike. When you're learning to ride a bike, you're using training wheels, and you're only trying to get so far. And then the real first accomplishment is when those training wheels come off, and then you're going, and then you go a little bit, and then you still fall down. You fall down, of course you do, but then you get better and better at it. But the thing about, if you really are passionate about riding that bike, all of a sudden you're going to start to trick the bike out a bit. You're going to start to take longer rides. You're going to look at better bikes. You're going to start to be more mindful about your approach to the actual act of cycling. And now you won't call it biking anymore. You'll say, oh, it's cycling. I'm a cyclist. And you can see that where I live. We live in the cycling capital of Canada, and you see cyclists of all various skill levels, and you can tell by looking at them and how they act and how they carry themselves as to what level of skill they're at. Like, we have a bike to work week here and all that stuff. So we're really, there's some, you know, rabidness to it to a certain extent. And I think that the same thing happens for a productivityist, is that when I started out, I had the training wheels. You know, I used the Covey day planner. I even used some of the Anthony Robbins stuff. So I was researching all the different things, and I felt, you know, all of a sudden I had the system that I had in mind, and I kept going with it. And then I started to dive into applications and stuff, and started to write more about the how to. But once you get past that point, I think being a productivityist becomes more about the why to do than the how to do. So you become more mindful. You start to make choices that are based about the things that you really want to do, as opposed to the things you have to do. You still do the things you have to do, but they're not the driving force anymore. I think when you start, they are, because you have all these things on your list. But then you eventually get to the point where you're going to use your mastery and mastery, or even just your expertise in productivity and practices in productivity, actually do the things that you want to do, which is why you want to be more productive in the first place. You don't want to be more productive to do all the things you have to do. That would be a really bad reason to want to be productive.
Agreed.
But when you find that, when you can connect with those things you want to do, and it's about connecting with those things as opposed to the platforms that you're using. The platforms are just sort of the conduit to kind of connect you with those things. I mean, I often say sometimes you need to disconnect to really connect. Step away from your task list, from your project management tool, whatever, and just kind of, you know, like we talked about before on the call, meditate, do some yoga, do something, so you can really get into like who you are. And I think when you enter that realm of being a productivityist and a productivity enthusiast, or even a specialist or whatever, you're more mindful about the approaches. You're more thoughtful, because we can't get everything done. We just want to get the right things done. So we stop focusing on doing productive, and we actually are being productive. I think that's the goal.
Yeah, and your point, I noticed the emphasis when you said the word why a number of times, which ties into that recent post that I read on the productivityist.com website that you wrote called The Why. And I really enjoyed it, but I'm a bit biased because for the past 3 years, everything in my life has revolved around that simple question. Why? Why should I? Why could I? Why do I need to? Why haven't I? Those types of questions. And you said training wheels and slowly getting into it more. And has that always been such a big deal in your life? Always that you were talking about shifting maybe a little bit from how in terms of how to, which I know you're great at doing, but moving more towards why. Is that the most important question for us to answer in all aspects of our life?
I don't think it's the easiest question to answer. I think it's the necessary one because, I mean, even how is not an easy question. It can be, the interesting thing is when you say, how do I use this a task manager? How do I get into productivity? Okay, well, here's 100,000 sites you could go see. So there you go. But why do you want to get into productivity? Well, that's a tougher question to answer. And there's generally, it's going to be, your answer is going to be different than my answer. So it's a tougher question. It's one that you kind of want to shy away from because it's the path is a lot rockier. It's a lot more difficult. Sometimes you have to disappoint people you love, people that you know, that you are with that you may not be able to be with any longer if you make that choice. I think having kids changes it too. Like, I mean, my son Colton is actually named after the singer Jonathan Colton. And when I left Costco, or when I was thinking about leaving Costco, I actually wrote him a letter. And Jonathan Colton, for those people who don't know who he is, he's a independent singer-songwriter who was worked for a software company. I think he was an engineer. He was doing the thing a week. So he's doing musician stuff as well. And when his child was born, he up and left his software job. And this was it was paying him pretty well and went full-time to become a musician. And all of a sudden, he's making really good money, doing what he loves to do, playing music for a living. Getting songs ripped off from him by Fox on Glee and stuff. If you saw that episode where they just sang Baby Got Back, that was his version first. I'll let you know. When I ended up getting ready to leave Costco, I actually wrote him a letter saying, hey, here's what I want to do. I want to pursue comedy. I want to be more creative, but this other thing's holding me back. What should I do? He wrote me back a letter basically saying, I think you should quit. P.S. Don't tell your wife that I told you that I think you should quit. Huh. It stuck. I didn't quit out and out. What I did was, and I think this is important too, is when you're looking at that why, the how is easy. Because, I mean, for me, like, why do I want, I want to become more creative. I want to be able to focus my energy on this. Well, how do I do that? Well, quit your job. Okay, but how do I do that? Because it leads to another how. Well, how do I do that without, you know, not being able to provide for my kids? Okay, right. Well, so what I did was I stepped down to part-time and it gave me some element of control back, but it also made sure that I could still bring in income. So the why to me is always the first question that you have to ask because it's the backbone, it's the foundation. I mean, you don't build a house without having a foundation first. Otherwise, the house is going to crumble, right? It's not going to be built on solid ground. So the why is the first reason. Like, why are you going to buy a PC over a Mac? Or why are you? Those kind of things are what you need to focus on first and foremost. Then the how-tos, they'll start to pile up. And those how-tos, again, there's lots of sites out there that can help you out with that. But the why, I think only you can really help yourself by looking inward on that.
I don't really know what to latch onto there. You've given me about 10 different things that I'm curious about. Maybe the one about Baby Got Back and the Glee episode. I don't watch Glee, but I do know all the words to Baby Got Back. Somebody can test me sometime. Big Sir Mix-a-Lot fan, which apparently he didn't write that. It was John Colton, you're saying?
No. Sir Mix-a-Lot wrote it. Jonathan Colton covered it. Glee took his cover version and basically, you know, note per note. There's lots of evidence online to see this. Basically used his version on their show and didn't credit him.
Well, I'll ponder that one separately. I don't know if people need to hear me reflecting upon that. But, you know, as you're talking about more of the why, and I'd love to hear some of your specific thoughts about using that to forward your goals and your mission when it comes to simplifying and organizing. But one of the things that you have here, and maybe we can even get into a periodic segment of the show that I like to call unofficially, of course, How Crazy Is Joel? Because you must have a big why between, or behind, I should say, golf. Because The Front Nine, your new book that's out here, uses golf from what I understand, I haven't read it yet, although I'd like to read it sometime in the near future, uses golf as a metaphor for goal setting and for productivity. And I've recently forsaken golf forever. I even posted back in 2011 a rant on Value of Simple called "Are You Helping Deprive the World of Water?" And it was essentially a rant about the water consumption and other resource consumption of golf courses around the world. So kind of getting into your book a little bit and some of the themes that you have on there and maybe the why between drawing that parallel between golf and goal setting and productivity, or why should we focus on those goal setting and productivity aspects of life, and how can you use golf as a metaphor for it?
It's funny because you've played golf, so you there are certain aspects of golf, and I mean, I'm not a big golf player. I'll be the first to admit that. I'm far better at mini putt, but it's interesting because when you look at golf, and I mean, I live in a part of the world where people golf all year round. We don't get much snow here in Western Canada on the island. So, I mean, for me, I looked at it and like there's certain aspects of golf that can apply towards, you know, getting, you know, making a goal happen. Like you're trying to reach this goal, which is this hole that is, you know, hundreds of yards away. And the first thing you do when you step up to the tees, you size up your shot. Now, I mean, some golfers, and you know this as well, if not better than I do, have a better drive than others. Some just shoot it really hard and fast and it goes, but maybe they don't have the best aim, so it goes, you know, off to the right and they're going to have a much tougher second shot. Some people take a bit more time, a bit more methodical, and they're able to hit a really precise shot, but they don't shoot it nearly as far, so they're going to have to take a few more shots to get to where they want to go. And then there's like the measured approach, which is like, okay, I'm going to hit it not quite as hard as I know I can and not quite as accurate as I know I can, but I'm going to hit it so that I can get to that spot there. So they're not necessarily looking at the flag. They're looking at, you know, down the course. So that's the drive. I call that the drive. And I think that when we start a new project or we start a new year, we all want to start off going fast, hard and heavy, right? We talk about New Year's resolutions, and I'm not a big believer in them, but a lot of people will say, okay, I'm going to start my new year January 1st, and I'm going to, you know, start doing yoga January 1st. Well, think about it. We've just come out of, especially down in the States, 6 weeks of like energy draining holiday season, right? Thanksgiving. Then you've got the Christmas shopping season or the holiday shopping season. Then you've got the holidays. Then you come, and right between the period of Christmas Day and New Year's Eve, you're really supposed to focus on the new thing, the new project, the new habit you're going to take on in 5 days. Tell me it's like running a really long race, and then right when the race is done, it goes, okay, it's time for a 100-meter sprint. No, like you're just not, I mean, the chances of success are far slimmer. The only reason people generally either have success or do it in the first place is because it's crowdsourced, right? There's a lot of people doing it. But for me, I tend to start my new year later, and you can start your year anytime you want. And when I started writing the book, I thought the front nine was just the first nine holes. But I didn't realize that the front nine actually meant the first nine holes you play. So if you and I were to golf together, although you've sworn off golf and I rarely golf, but let's just pretend that we're going to go golf together.
Sure, of course. We'd have a great time.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So you're there at 1 o'clock. You're there at 9 a.m. for tee time, and I'm stuck at traffic. And you're like, all right, I'm going to start my tee times at 9. You join me up. You know, I'm going to keep playing. So you play, and I arrive by hole 3. Well, your front nine are going to be the first nine holes you played, and my front nine are going to be the first nine holes that I play, and then we handicap, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I could still win. I could still score better than you, even though I'm starting later, right?
Sure.
There's a very good chance of that. So I think that's when you look at the new year, the concept of the calendar new year, if I was to start yoga in March, which I did, versus starting it in January, I'm going to have because I'm more prepared, because I'm ready, my energy level is up, you know, I may have a better shot of lasting longer than the person who starts in January. Right? So I think that's one of the concepts that I talk about when I talk about the front nine. Then I talk about, you know, the hazards and when you're on the fairway, that's the second part of the book, and how you can avoid hazards, what hazards can mean. And then, of course, on the green, which is the third part of the book, I talk about the short game, which, you know, is probably the most difficult and often most overlooked part of playing the game, and can be the most frustrating. Is, you know, we're all great at starting, but we're not as good as not as good at finishing up. So that's the concept behind it. So I think there's a lot of parallels that you can draw, whether you're a golfer or not. Golfers will definitely buy into it because, like, oh yeah, I totally know. You know, I'll use this club for this, and I'll use this tool for that, and that's kind of how that works with goals and with new projects you're tackling. One tool may work better than another in specific situations, and non-golfers can look at it and go, okay, I can remove the golf element from it, and there are some parts where I remove golf from it and take something from it in that regard as well.
Sure, well, I like the analogy. And this kind of goes back to an old saying, at least in golf circles, which is drive for show, putt for dough, meaning the big hitters off the tee, those are the folks, ooh, you just drove it 300 yards. Wow, isn't that impressive? Well, if it takes you 9 more shots to get the ball into the cup, then you're not a very good golfer overall. So being able to start is wonderful. A lot of people really get stuck just at the starting process. They get paralyzed. So that's a really important skill to have. But the ability to finish, that is something that I continue to try to improve on. I feel like I've been getting a little bit better, but anyone who helps me finish what I start is always someone who I'm interested in talking to. And I got to tell you, when it comes to a long, middle, and short game in the real game of golf, it was kind of on the brutal side. My brother got the good golfing genes in the family. I think he took them all, actually.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, being out here, you'd think I'd golf more, but I don't. I'm interested. I watch it more now. I was at the Science World in Vancouver yesterday as we record this. And there was a picture of a mechanical sculpture of two golfers, and I was watching it and watching the motions and stuff. And I'm like, you know, I never used to pay as much attention to golf until I started writing a book that had parallels of golf involved. So, I mean, who knows? Maybe I'll start hitting the links. You never know.
Well, tell me this. There's a lot of things that seem like it falls into the paradigm of the golf metaphor and the productivityist paradigm. I'm kind of curious, and folks who listen to the show frequently know that simplicity and organizing and personal finance are prominent themes that we hit on here. But one thing that I believe you have touched on in the past, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about here, where do spreadsheets fall in terms of achieving goals or finding out how we can utilize them, maybe even in a non-technical way, in order to meet some of the challenges that are in front of us?
Spreadsheets are the thing that I use spreadsheets for mainly, honestly, at this point, is I use them a lot for bookkeeping, but I tend to use a lot of apps, but spreadsheets are good in that they are as flexible and malleable as you want them to be. They're yours to work with, right? It's like those grid notebooks, right? You look at a grid, like lined notebooks, you feel that you have to work within the lines, and you know, and then the ones that are plain, you're like, okay, I can go everywhere else. But gridded ones, which is kind of what a spreadsheet is, it's grids, right? Is it gives you a bit of structure, but not, you can add to the structure or take away from the structure as you see fit. I use grids. Like for the yoga that I'm taking on right now, I'm using it basically to chronicle, you know, how long I do yoga, and you know, so that deliberate practice thing. That have you read Cal Newport's book, So Good They Can't Ignore You?
I have not.
It's a fantastic book. It's a book where he talks about how skills often can trump the passion to find the work that you love. It's a very interesting concept. It's almost counterintuitive to what a lot of people say, which is pursue your passion. He actually goes a little bit in the other direction. But he talks about the idea of deliberate practice. And like a golfer would spend hours on the putting green and hours at the driving range, right? And what I do is, like, for writing, I actually used and you can create a spreadsheet, and I did for deliberate practice. So I would mark down, you know, how many hours I spent writing, or how many pages I wrote that day, or how many words. And for yoga, I'm chronicling, you know, how many minutes or you can go as simple as, did I do yoga today? X, yes. So to me, that's the novelty, and that's the usefulness of, and novelty is not the right, but the usefulness of spreadsheets is that they have this, they're simple, and that you can make them as complex as you want them to be, but because they're so flexible and malleable, you can use them for pretty much anything, as long as the key is to use them. Once you start, there's nothing worse, again, than looking at a spreadsheet that you've built, and you look at it and it's not finished, or you stopped using it. That to me, it's like staring you right in the face, saying, "Oh, you know, I didn't quite finish that. I didn't live up to what I had set out to do when I built this thing." So that's where I kind of use them. Whereas In other cases, like for task management and stuff, I'll use an app because it's designed for that. But if there's something that, like, for deliberate practice purposes, say I want to get better at playing guitar, I'll use a spreadsheet to kind of track that stuff, because it's just that to me is a lot easier. And it's great to track those kind of habits and make sure that you are moving closer to the goal that you want, that you set for yourself, whether it's mastery in one form or another.
I think you just hit on something important there when you were talking about using the tools that you have and not building something, or say downloading an app and then never using it, or getting a book, Cal Newport's book, for example. Maybe if it sits on the bookshelf for a decade, it's not really doing you any good. You're adding a whole bunch of things, physical or digital, to your life, but they're not adding any kind of value. They're just cluttering up the joint, if you will. So as somebody who continually likes to test and try and tweak and see new things, I mean, you're very much in the world of what's new and what's next. How do you limit yourself to just the best of the best? How do you not take on a whole bunch of things and then just complicate the heck out of your life and your wife and your kids and everyone else around you?
I've gotten a lot better at it over the years. My time at Lifehack definitely helped. And same with the Next Web, because I was getting a lot of apps and software to test. So, I mean, for me, what I do is I actually have a template for every single, like I have a working template that I can easily put into any kind of application that I'm using. And I test it with that. So that way I'm removed enough from the app itself to give it kind of an honest evaluation. And I'm also not putting anything in there that I'm going to need to reflect back on that could have a negative impact or possibly even a positive one on my productivity. So for example, if I'm using OmniFocus, which I do use for my individual task management, that's where I go for the stuff that really matters to me. And that's my go-to. But if I'm using something, say like Finish, which was an iOS app that came out that helps with GTD and stuff like that, I'll put like this task A, task B kind of thing in there. So I use that for testing purposes only. It helps me to remain connected to the app that I know that I've really gotten down pat, and also puts me in a position to offer, honestly, some better feedback, because I'm not as emotionally invested in those apps. So that to me is a big thing.
And it all starts with that template that you have. Do you apply a template? Do you have a system for evaluating the efficacy or how much value is being brought into your life or the life of the people who you care about, who you love and respect? Do you apply that kind of template approach to other aspects of your life?
Not really. I think when it comes to templates, I use them when I'll use them for things that I want to get through fairly quickly. Like I use Text Expander a lot. And when I was working for Lifehack, I think I had 92 Text Expander snippets for responses to emails, because I had to respond very quickly, and I wanted to make sure I offered a response that didn't seem super canned. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't want to sound like too impersonal, but I also knew that if I spent too much time in email that I wouldn't be able to get the real work done. So there's certain things. It's funny, I was using an app called Close, which I still use, and I was testing it, and I replied to my wife with something, and the response, because of the natural response in Close, seems very canned. At least to my wife it did, because she's like, did you respond with an app? Like, she knew right away. So I tend not to use templates for that kind of thing. That for me, if I'm looking at for people who, when people I'm connecting with and stuff, that's where I put my energy. So that's why the templates are so valuable, because it allows me to put my energy and my thought and my mindfulness into the things, into the relationships that I'm fostering with these other people. So that's where the templates actually help that, but I don't actually use them in that process.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, Text Expander is a tool where you can use a series of hotkeys or shortcut keys to do something to write in pre-populated text. So if I typed Control RT, for example, on my keyboard, it would type in something like, Mike Vardy is awesome and I love following him around the internet. Although I wouldn't use that as a Text Expander, Mike. Although maybe I'll consider using it more in the future. Probably.
Maybe.
Could come up with a better example. Hey, why not, right? But I like the way that you frame that, in that templates allow you to focus on the things that have more value to you. They allow you to take care of some of the mindless stuff, or automate certain things, or evaluate certain things that have less prominence than the things that are important to you. and your family, mm-hmm. your friends, your relationships, your spirituality, and whatever it is that you value the highest in your life. I've used that approach too, and it's worked really well for me. And it seems like for all of these things that you have, and one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show as well is I want to talk to you a little bit about this thing called curating. And I have kind of a funny view of curating, much different than, say, the Dewey Decimal System or your grandma's art museum artifacts and arranging them in an order that you'd go see in an art museum, for example. You know, when I talk about curating, I'm talking about, in the broadest sense, filtering the best experiences that you have, organizing and archiving and adding context to those experiences, and then being able to share and access those experiences, those moments that have rich value for you and for other people whenever you like. Do you do that? Do you have any topics that you curate or parts of your life that you curate?
I journal a lot. So I use journaling. So I will, every day, day one prompts me, which is a journaling app for both the Mac and iOS, which is a fantastic application. I will go in there and chronicle the day's events, and I tag them as well. So I will actually tag them with you know, things that are important. I also wrote a post, and I think I wrote this for Lifehack, where I will use contexts that have emotion or traits attached to them. So if I want to, for example, I don't use like gifts as a context. I'll use like gratitude or love or something like that. So that way I can connect, because that kind of stuff helps me connect with a task better. And it's not for every task, for every project. Like I want to build a time capsule with my kids. Well, that to me, that could be a household project if I want to name it that, right, with that context. But instead I call it a gratitude or family or knowledge. So I'll chronicle it in a way, excuse me, or categorize it in a way that gives me a deeper connection to it. Because I think that with curation, and it's kind of like we talked about with the templates and stuff, is that it allows me to parse out the stuff that then filter through that stuff so I can really connect with those things that matter. And trigger words like emotional-based context or even energy to a certain extent can help. Because, there are certain tasks that take a lot of high energy, and there are certain tasks that, you know, like today, for example, is a low energy day for me because I'm a little bit under the weather. And also I just came off doing a couple of talks yesterday, right? So for me, it's a low energy day. So I'll look at what my low energy tasks are, and that's one method of curation. And today is also a day where I don't have the kids at home. So it's actually can be low energy in that regard. But on Tuesdays and Wednesdays when my kids are home, especially my son, my daughter goes to school, those are high energy days, but in a completely different element. So by applying that context, I can say, you know, take son to aquarium, because we took him to the aquarium in Vancouver and he lost his mind, and now he wants to go to the one in Victoria. So I think that to me, the journaling aspect is huge, because that not only helps me curate, but also helps me generate content in my head for future posts where I'll put like that in drafts or something like that. But I think that to me is big. I think for anyone who wants to start curating, I think journaling is a huge, huge thing, because it's the first step to really connecting with what's really important to you. And that's the first step, I think, in curation.
Is it the format that's appealing, though? Being able, and when you're talking about journaling, you're talking about doing it in a digital way so that you have access to it wherever it is that you go, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is that format, the long hand, or I guess it's typed, not written, so being able to type in free flow and get your mind into a different state, is the format important, or is it what you're journaling about that's more important?
I think it's the process that's more important than what you are. I think when you start, it's again the process of it, why you're journaling, again, how to journal. I mean, I've used analog tools as well, and I've written stuff, and I still use paper a lot. I have really great pens and really great notebooks, and I've done that as well. I think the process of it is hugely important, because it's a habit. You want to build that habit. Again, a great way to use a spreadsheet is to say, you know, I've journaled every day this week or whatnot. I think when you start that, it's like anything. When you write and you start writing, you're going to be a bit rigid. You're going to be a bit wooden. But once you start to explore, and especially in journaling, because you may not show anybody. You may, but you may not. It allows you to kind of enter that flow, enter that ability to kind of let go a little bit. And that's when the real gems start to come out. Like I'll probably, I mean, this journal, it's digital. It's great. I mean, when my kids are, when I'm gone and my kids want to look at it, they're going to see how my day shaped up, what I thought about the day, you know, and I keep that in mind. I mean, I don't, you know, I think that that's important too. But I think the process is where you have to start. Because once you start with the process, then the other stuff starts to really come out. And it'll come out at moments where you won't expect it to.
Yeah, I found that it's always good to have a tool. It could be a pen and paper, it could be your smartphone, whatever it is, to be able to capture your thoughts. And it is a little bit about leaving a legacy. You're talking about journaling and not doing it for the benefit of your children, but realizing that there are other people, other generations who are going to go back and want to chronicle your life and understand you better. And by doing that, whether it's journaling or curating in the way that I do it through spreadsheets and being able to sort and filter and making it easy on the people who are encountering what you have to offer, it to me, it's almost like a form of self-expression, whether it's journaling or whether it's keeping the essential moments of your life, the restaurants, the recipes, the online content that you read, being able to have that where you can share it if you want, when it's appropriate and instantly access it is huge. It's cool to hear your way of doing it, which is a little bit different than most of the other folks that I've talked to about the topic. You know, I want to make sure that we get an opportunity to chat about something a little bit fun. I always like to have people talk about something that's interesting. So I thought it might be fun to ask you, and feel free to deflect this one or just talk about whatever the heck you want instead. I wanted to know, when are you going to start performing comedy again or writing some chuckling-inducing stuff?
It's funny. When I was at the OmniFocus setup this earlier this year, one of the people at the Omni Group said that the eventualism stuff that you used to write, I really miss it. And I hadn't heard that in a long while. I actually heard, you know, it's the thing about writing, and when I say eventualism is when I was doing productivity parody. That's kind of how I got started. I was doing like a Stephen Colbert-esque take on it. The site's still up. You can go look at it. It's eventualism.com. And I am starting to work on some stuff in the background, some fiction-based stuff. But right now, see, when you're freelancing and you've got your kids and stuff, you want to, and I want to make sure that I'm providing for them, obviously. But I also don't want to take away from, because I'm still working at this stuff. I'm still working at being a, getting better at what I do and creating things that can help people get better at what they do. So it's definitely there. It's not gone. It's not going away. When I speak, there's definitely going to be some humor. I mean, you were in our session at NMX, right? So yeah. You saw it. So, I mean, Brett and I had a few chuckles with one another and stuff like that. And it's never going to go away. The question, when am I going to bring it back? Am I going to bring back eventualism? Maybe eventually.
I see what you did there. Nice.
But I'm not going to put a date on it yet because there's so many other things I still think I need to do in this realm. And honestly, I'm glad I got out of the sketch comedy stuff when I did because we were doing pretty well. We actually, the comedy troupe I founded, we had performed in San Francisco and in Chicago, not Chicago, Washington, D.C. and Seattle. And we were doing a lot of great things. And if I had kept going down that route, I don't know my life would be the same. I don't even know, honestly, if I would be, my wife and I would be together because I'd be on the road a lot and that's tough. So I have to kind of, you know, it's something I think about, but I'm not putting a date on it because there's a lot of ways that I want to be able to do it that works not just for me, but for my family.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you one last thing, which is, is there anything that we didn't talk about that you'd like people to know about you or that you're working on or any of your future plans? Because since we're not going to be going to eventualism.com anytime soon, at least most of us aren't.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. I can be clever every once in a while, too. It's rare. It's rare. I'm pretty sure there's a blue moon tonight. Is there something that we didn't talk about that you'd like folks to know?
Well, I'm revamping my Ready Retreat series of workbooks right now. I think I'm going to basically they're going to be turned into what's called the Productivityist workbook. So I'm going to be re-releasing those probably, we're recording this in mid-March. So it'll probably by the beginning of April, they'll be available, at productivityist.com. I'm doing, I don't have any real speaking stuff going on, other than some stuff locally. I'm appearing at Social Media Camp and the World Domination Summit, which I think you're going to be at the World Domination Summit again, aren't you?
I will. I am incredibly excited for that.
So am I. There's going to be so many awesome. I mean, Chris Brogan's coming back, and he's doing something musical.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Double whoa.
So, I mean, there's that. And then just, you know, visit my site, productivityist.com. I publish there probably about 3 to 4 times a week now, because I'm still, you know, I'm doing some guest posts for the book. And, of course, you can get the book, The Front Nine, at your favorite online reseller, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, wherever you're at. And there's now the print version. So the print version, I think, is $9.99, and the digital version is $4.99.
Right on. Well, there's a lot of other places that we can find you too, but you've hit on some of the big ones. You're all over the place, which is cool. You blow a lot of dandelion seeds all across the far corners of the internet, and I love chasing them down for folks who are doing some pretty cool stuff. And I know that you help people do lots of things better and faster and smarter, and we can tell from just our chat here that in a pretty clever way. I definitely support that, and I like every once in a while to help folks do something new as well, and helping people attempt a project. We were talking about projects a lot today that they didn't think that they could start, let alone finish, kind of like your golf metaphor that you have there. And you know, this project, this tiny little idea that you have in the back of your mind in terms of turning it into something amazing that you share with the world, that kind of project that fulfills the promise that you have inside of you, unlocking your time, money, and talent, as I like to talk about on Value of Simple. So it's in that spirit that I created a resource. It's called the Digital Launch Playbook. And it's for clever and skillful people, maybe like me and you and everyone else who's listening, who need that small push or maybe even a giant shove to make their digital project of Uberness real. It's true about the rumors. It is a giant spreadsheet. It's the greatest spreadsheet that I've ever created, and even people who aren't spreadsheet enthusiasts like me have said that it kind of rocked their world in a couple of different ways. So there are folks who are already using the Digital Launch Playbook to conceptualize and create content, market and sell, and build their digital kingdoms and celebrate their success with a drink of their choice. I just want to encourage everybody to go to valueofsimple.com/TDLP. That's for the Digital Launch Playbook, and check it out. See if it's a solid fit for you or if another digital champ that you know might make use of it. With that said, Mike, I just want to say thanks again for joining me today. It was insightful and fun, and I believe the folks who are listening are going to agree with that statement.
Thanks a lot, Joel. I love the questions and I love being here, and thanks for having me.
Cool. Well, it's now time for your partner in simplifying to sign off once again. You've just listened to the Smart and Simple Matters podcast with Joel Zaslavsky, creator of all things Value of Simple.